We'll hear argument now in number 88-1725, Juan Francisco Venegas versus Michael Mitchell. Mr. Mosk.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. The issue in this civil rights case is whether respondent Mitchell, an attorney, can, by enforcing a contingent fee contract, require petitioner Juan Francisco Venegas, who is the client and the prevailing party in a civil rights action, to pay over $800,000 in attorney's fees when the court awarded, pursuant to Section 1988, fees in the amount to the then-attorneys of $102,000, which was almost twice the amount of the lodestar and twice the amount requested, and which included a contingency enhancement factor. In short, the issue is whether 1988 is to operate as a fee-sharing statute or a fee-shifting statute. Now, prior to Mitchell, the case had been pending some 8 years. All of the discovery had been completed, all of these law and motion materials, including summary judgment motions, appeals, and pretrials, had been completed.
Well, Mr. there's no issue in this case about what the defendant would have to pay.
There's no issue. That's correct, Your Honor.
The lodestar amount is all that he has to pay.
That's correct.
All right, thank you.
It was a projected short trial. Indeed, in volume one of the transcript, Mr. Mitchell himself anticipated a four-day trial. There was a high probability of a large recovery in that in the state court, a jury had awarded $1 million, which was reversed on the basis of sovereign immunity, which, of course, was a defense not available in a civil rights action. Mr. Mitchell had Mr. Venegas pay him a $10,000 non-refundable retainer. That meant he kept it win, lose, or draw, and had him sign his standard form contingent fee contract, which provided for 40% of the recovery for one trial only, plus he would keep any civil rights award which exceeded that amount.
Do we know that that was his standard form contract?
Well, it was a printed form contract, Your Honor. Yes.
Including the one trial limitation?
That would be the assumption, yes. There's no evidence to that effect other than it appears to be a printed form contract.
It has been asserted that that's unusual, that particular feature is unusual in contingent fee contracts.
Well, it is our position that it is unusual, and indeed the Court of Appeals, when it said that Mr. Venegas had the burden of showing that 40% contingency was unusual in a civil rights action, never drew that distinction, that this was 40% for one trial only. And as a matter of fact, the way Petitioner Venegas construed it, which was not unreasonable, was that if he lost, Mr. Mitchell would not have to do the trial, do the appeal, without extra consideration, but that in order to effect the recovery, he had to do the appeal and undertake the recovery.
Yeah, is that the right way to interpret? I wondered the same. I would interpret one trial to mean, you know, if it's a hung jury, I don't do a second trial, but if I win, I'll defend the verdict.
That would be the reasonable way of interpreting it. Not the way Mr. Mitchell interpreted it, however.
Mr. Musk, does the Central District, that's where this case was tried, wasn't it?
Yes, sir.
Have any policy of regulating contingent fees?
Well, Your Honor, the answer is no, not by rule. The Ninth Circuit has indicated, and all courts have indicated, that courts are supposed to supervise. There is no specific regulation, and indeed, the district court in this case simply said that as a matter of law, in a civil rights case, a contingent fee agreement is enforceable even if it exceeds the amount of the court-awarded fee. And the only other thing that the district court said was, and I quote, plaintiff does not claim that he did not read the agreement before signing it. And that was the sum total of the district court's findings and consideration of this fact.
But you haven't made any independent claim here that the contingent fee should have been reviewed the way all contingent fees would be, regardless of a civil rights case.
No, Your Honor, other than to say that all contingent fees agreements, and especially in civil rights cases, when called to the attention of the court, the court has a duty to exercise supervisory power over them, as they have done in every court throughout the nation.
Have we held that? Have we confirmed that authority in the district court?
No, Your Honor, you have not. Although, as I said, all of the cases seem to say, and including the one in the Ninth Circuit in this case, has said that contingent fee contracts are subject to the supervision of the court.
And does that supervision go to all aspects of the contract, its validity, its execution?
It goes to its fairness and to the circumstances surrounding it. Just as an example, in the Ninth Circuit, in this case, in footnote 7, said that when there is a civil rights action, the plaintiff's attorney may not get both the court award, the statutory fee, and the contingent fee. Now, there's nothing anywhere that says he can't. Why not? The freedom of contract under respondent's theory, but that was a rule which they laid down themselves. They also, in Hamner versus Rios, established certain criteria and guidelines, which we submit were not followed at all, because in this particular case, the court placed the burden upon Mr. Venegas to show that the contract was unreasonable, and secondly, it completely ignored the factors related to the execution of the agreement and the great disparity between the amount asked for and the amount that was deemed to be reasonable, and finally, didn't consider considered a contract reasonable, which is manifestly unenforceable, both under state and federal law, by virtue of the fact that the attorney had withdrawn prior to the advent of the contingency.
Did Venegas have his own counsel at that point, or was he in these hearings in the district court? That is, a counsel other than Mitchell to represent him on this contingency fee inquiry?
At a point in time, after Mr. Mitchell, who was counsel of record, filed his lien, at some point, at the hearing itself, another counsel had to be hired and was hired and did present written argument, yes.
But apparently none of the parties make any objection to the authority of the district court to make this determination. And whatever the determination is with respect to the contingency fee contract, that is going to be binding on all the parties for state law purposes?
The answer is nobody objected to the determination as such. Whether it's binding or not is another question.
Well, I thought the district court really only made some remarks about it. That really left it to the state law.
No, the district court blessed the contract as reasonable, as did the Ninth Circuit. Now,
but said it was really a matter for the state law to take care of, didn't they?
Well, except for what we consider is that the first bastion, the first guard, is the court itself in which the attorney appears, in which all the facts are demonstrated. At that point, it is up to the court, it seems to us.
You think the validity of every contract, contingent fee contract, in a case that's tried in federal court, the validity of that contract is a matter of federal law?
No, Your Honor, but if a contract comes...
Well, what is it a matter of?
It is a matter of the federal court determining at that stage, as they have in many, many cases...
With reference to what law?
In reference to federal law.
So it is a federal law issue, the validity of that contract?
In a federal... Well, it's not the question so much as the validity. It's the question of the regulation of the attorney and the reasonableness of it. It is true that if this court determines, for example, that the contract is, quote, reasonable, Mr. Venegas will still have the opportunity in state court to litigate questions such as fraud. But in state court, the issue will not necessarily arise, it may in some context, as to the, quote, reasonableness. It is for the court itself to determine whether or not the contract before it is reasonable.
Let's assume that this contract is completely valid and enforceable in state court. And if this case had been tried in state court, the contingent fee contract would have been enforceable and valid, no questions about it.
Except for the Fracassee versus Brent, the withdrawal aspect.
That may be so, but let's just assume that it would be enforceable in state court. What basis does the federal court have, other than the policy of the civil rights statute, to not enforce it?
Because it's not a question of not enforcing it, Your Honor. It's a question of the court basically determining whether, under these circumstances, it is reasonable or unreasonable.
I know, but if it determines it's unreasonable, it won't enforce it. So it is a question of enforceability.
Well, it is a question of enforceability, yes. But by the flip side of that is that in these Section 1988 cases, the courts have, in effect, enforced the agreements. For example, in several of the cases cited by the respondent, the court has required the client to pay his attorney the difference between the court award and the contingent fee. Therefore, part of the court's function is to protect the attorney and also to protect the client.
Well, I can understand the court, maybe a federal court, saying, well, we've got this matter before us, we might as well deal with this contingent fee contract, but then saying it's a matter of state law. And we'll find out what the state law is and apply state law to it, not some independent federal standard.
Well, all we're suggesting, Your Honor, is that it's the first line of defense, because an attorney is an officer of the court before whom he or she appeared, is to determine whether or not that attorney, for example, is taking undue advantage of his client. For example, if the contract had been...
Well, Mr. Musk, I thought you argued, with reference to the third question raised in your petition, that a federal court in a civil rights case should not uphold a contingent fee agreement which is unenforceable under state law.
Correct.
So I thought your argument was to the effect that the federal court had to look to state law for enforceability. Your responses to Justice White's questions indicate quite the reverse this morning.
Our position, Your Honor, is that, number one, as a matter of federal law, the court should not enforce a contract, a contingent fee contract, where the lawyer has withdrawn prior to the advent of the contingency, because that is a matter of general law. Our next argument is that a federal court should not bless or deem a contract to be reasonable if it violates state law, which it did here also.
But the first of those arguments isn't raised in your petition for certiorari.
Yes, it is, Your Honor. And in the second item, where we deal with the question of the enforceability of the agreement, basically, under the circumstances of this case, we do not highlight each and every fact situation, but in our brief, certainly, we raise that issue.
Well, I hope you will devote some of your time, and of course, your ability to do that depends on questions from the bench as well as your own schedule, I realize, to the question of the first question presented.
Yes, Your Honor. The first question presented really goes to the court's ability to, which it has done in each and every case, to basically take what's a skeletal statute and carry out its purposes and intent by a number of rules, which has been referred to by Judge Posner in his book on federal courts as a type of federal common law. Let me give one example. There is nothing in Section 1988 that provides a different statutory guideline as between prevailing plaintiffs and prevailing defendants. Not a word. And indeed, there are a number of statutes which statutorily provide for such a distinction between the standard for defendants and for plaintiffs. Indeed, one of them is the Hart-Scott-Rodino Antitrust Act, the Petroleum Marketing Act. A number of acts have that specific distinction. Nevertheless, this court in Hughes versus Roe in 1980 judicially enacted that different standards on the grounds that it carries out the purposes and the intent of the statute. Now, respondent has simply said, well, what about all these other fee limitation statutes? Congress knows how to say it or do it, and therefore they didn't do it in this case. And the answer to that is that Those fee limitation statutes are basically dedicated toward protecting a particular group of people, coal miners, for example. They are also the purposes to protect the federal fisc, because they're normally federal statutes, and in some instances to make the process less adversarial. Here we have a fee-shifting contract, which is not a fee limitation at all. There is no limitation on what the attorney can obtain. Basically, the only limitation is what the court deems to be reasonable. Now, the other argument, two other arguments that defendant respondent has made, and that is, this just involves the relationship between the plaintiff and the defendant and doesn't involve his attorney. That's not true. The statute deals with attorney's fees. It doesn't provide that the defendant shall pay plaintiff monies which he can then use to pay his attorney. It deals with a reasonable attorney's fees. It also, it's clear that Congress intended that the recovery not be reduced by what the plaintiff must pay his attorney, and that's stated in Blanchard versus Bergeron. I might add that if we assume that Congress is rational and that they act on the basis of case law as it exists, back in 1948 in the Fair Labor Standards Act case, the Second Circuit, the judge's hand, and Jerome Frank enunciated a proposition which was then picked up by the Third Circuit, and I think they said it better than I can say it, and it said, it seems to us too clear for argument that Congress did not intend the court to fix a fee sufficient to compensate the plaintiff's attorney for all his services and to permit him to collect an additional fee from his client under a private agreement. Such an arrangement would require the cooperation of the court and the frustration of congressional purposes. Moreover, in this case, the fee by contract belongs to the attorney. He said so. And finally, it seems to me that if the attorney is to be a co-venturer in this project, he should have the same risks. And the risk is, what does the judge determine is his reasonable fee? He should also have the risk, parenthetically, of having to undergo the obligation which the plaintiff has of paying the defendant in the event that the defendant is the prevailing party.
Mr. Moss, this argument you're making assumes that a reasonable attorney's fee is one single number, and that there couldn't be a whole bunch of reasonable attorney's fees that vary enormously in amount. So one might say that the fee awarded by the court here was a reasonable fee, and one might also say that the 40% contract agreement provided for a reasonable fee. I mean, there's a vast range of reasonableness. Why couldn't Congress have intended that it's up to the court? The court will pick a reasonable fee. That will be awarded to counsel so that plaintiff doesn't have to pay it. But if plaintiff has contractually obligated himself to pay more, that's something Congress didn't address.
Well, several reasons. First of all, if you look at the fee between the plaintiff and his attorney and the reasonable fee between plaintiff and defendant, there's no rational distinction between the two. They're both contingent. They both have the delay factor. They're both based on the lodestar or the amount of time.
Right. The contingent fee agreement with the client is not based on time at all.
Well, except that that's true, Your Honor. It's not based on time, except for the fact that I think that there has to be some. All courts, since the days of Blackstone, have regulated attorney-client contracts, and they have to be reasonable.
Well, there's just no relationship whatsoever in this case between the time and the amount of the fee.
That's correct.
$50,000 an hour.
I did misspeak on that one element. But as far as the contingency element, which some have said distinguishes the two, there is still a contingency factor in the 1988 fee, and there is a.
It's the difference between being a factor and being the standard. I mean, well, but contingency is one factor in the reasonable fee determination by the court, but it's the whole ballgame in this.
Yeah, but then, it's the whole ballgame either way. I mean, unless he wins, he doesn't get anything.
Well, he has to win, but in determining the amount of the fee, contingency is the entire standard under the contract. It's merely one of the factors in the course determination.
But he's better off with the 1988 between plaintiff and defendant, because if it's a low amount, he gets his time anyway. He is better off than the normal tort.
Well, some cases yes, some cases no. He's not better off in this case.
Well, in this case he gets a windfall which
he gets what he bargained for.
Well, as far as the contract aspect, and the respondent has said that a contract's a contract. But the fact is between an attorney and a client, a contract is not a normal commercial contract. A contract is between a fiduciary. It's a highly regulated contract. In this very case, as I've pointed out in footnote 7, the case itself in the Ninth Circuit says a contract where he bargains for both is unenforceable. And as I said, since the days of Blackstone, contracts which were deemed to be chambertus or baratree or whatever have all been deemed to be unenforceable by the courts.
But if that's true, I mean, if this contract is unenforceable for the reasons that it's really excessive, one could say that would be true whether or not there was a 1988 out there. I mean, that's an argument that's really independent of your statutory argument.
It's except for the fact that the contract is contrary to the legislative purpose. It basically violates that which Congress intended, which was that the plaintiff remain whole. For example.
But it also intended that the plaintiff be able to get lawyers who might not otherwise take the cases.
And the way they did that was to say that in the vast majority of cases where there are simply injunctive relief or declaratory relief or low recoveries, such as Mr. Blanchard in Blanchard versus Bergeron, the attorney will get his full recovery. But if you look at the distinction between Mr. Blanchard and our case, Mr. Blanchard suffers a little bit of damages at the hands of a sheriff. And as a result, he, after paying his attorney, he's made whole. Mr. Venegas spends 2.5 years wrongfully in prison, and he'll be lucky to get 60% of what he gets. In other words, it's the same thing as if you had a $1,000 hospital bill. The $1,000 hospital bill is fully paid after paying your attorney. If it's a $100,000 hospital bill, you only keep 60% of it.
Well,
that
assumes, and you know what opposing counsel is going to say, that assumes that he would have gotten the amount regardless of hiring this attorney. But he made a different judgment. He hired this attorney because he thought he'd increase the amount. And he may well have been right.
Well, he hired an attorney, and he got this amount. And the fact is that the other attorney, when we talk about the marketplace, and I know Justice O'Connor, in an opinion written for the court, or actually her own opinion in the Pennsylvania and Delaware, referred to the marketplace. The marketplace, with all due respect, is a fiction. The marketplace is based upon a monopoly of attorneys, and contingent fee agreements are basically standard form contracts of adhesion. There is no broker out there that directs you to the appropriate lawyer at the cheapest fee. There is no real competition.
These lawyers are just that you see advertised on television and in the newspapers. They're just throwing their money away.
Well, they're trying to get clients.
Which suggests that there's a market, doesn't it?
There's a lot of lawyers out there, but the fact is that as the respondent has pointed out, you look at all the cases and they all say 40%. And the fact is that in this case, what is so egregious is it was 40% after everything had been completed. And the trial, it was not at the beginning when he walks in the door. It's 40% after all discovery, after all law and motion.
That's true. It's true for everybody. I mean, and I suppose we shouldn't allow any contingent fees and should award all reasonable fees. Why should we think that Congress believes that somehow 1988 plaintiffs are some particularly dull-witted class, that they alone, among all litigants, have to be protected from hiring what they think is a better lawyer and agreeing to give him more than the statute would otherwise provide?
They don't have to do that, Your Honor. What they've provided and what they've said in the legislative history is the purpose of it is that a plaintiff in a civil rights act is a private attorney general. He's enforcing the law. As Senator Kennedy, the sponsor of the bill, says, you don't make a policeman pay to enforce the law. We view Mr. Venegas as a private attorney general. Sure, he's trying to be made whole, but the fact is it's different than a tort case, as was said in Rivera, Riverside versus Rivera. And as a result, the whole object was that he didn't have to pay for it. It was the defendant that had to pay for it. And what the court has done is saying, all right, we're not going to make the defendant pay anything that a plaintiff's attorney asks for. We're not going to shift whatever he says. Now, there's only one other way of making sure that plaintiff Benegas is made whole, and that is to say that the attorney can only charge a reasonable fee. I might add that...
Then you're saying that Congress virtually forbade contingent fees, if you're saying that the plaintiff must always be made whole.
That's a possibility, but I would think...
Well, but where on earth do you find that in Section 1988 or in anything that Congress said at that time?
Because many of the quotes which we've said, which we've laid out in our brief, and in this court itself specifically said that the purpose of the statute in Blanchard versus Bergeron, the purpose of the statute was to ensure that the plaintiff was made whole and did not have to disgorge a portion of his earnings to his counsel. And that's what Jerome Frank and the Third Circuit said with the Fair Labor Standards Act legislation. And
are you referring to the language where we said, thus it is that a plaintiff's recovery will not be reduced by what he must pay his counsel?
Yes.
But the word there is must. It is not required that you must have a contingency fee contract. You must pay him a reasonable fee.
Well, presumably it's an enforceable. Must, it seemed to me, to be an enforceable contract. In other words, I don't know that a contract...
The word must means you must hire an attorney, but doesn't follow from that you must execute a contingency fee contract.
Well, I think
that's the whole point.
I think respondent's position is that Venegas must pay him. I mean, that's what he's asking. And what we're suggesting is that whatever he must pay him, it shouldn't, his amount should not be reduced by that amount.
Well, we've never held that contingency recognition of the contingent nature of the recovery is not a legitimate factor in calculating a reasonable fee. We've said a lot of things about it, but we've never said that 1988 forbids in all cases the recognition of the contingent nature of the.
We don't have,
in this very case, I understand the reasonable fee that was calculated included a contingency factor.
That's correct, Your Honor. And it seems to us having determined that that's reasonable, a plaintiff's attorney should not be able to ask for what is unreasonable. Now, it's true there are other, there's a whole range. I mean, for example, it could have been 117 or one. By the way, the extra $15,000 went to a prior attorney who is now suing for six times that amount in state court. So that the attorneys, unfortunately, are not satisfied with whatever the judges are pronouncing. And what happens is that unless this court sets down some standard, it seems to me that we are going to have more of this collateral litigation between unfortunate civil rights plaintiffs and their attorneys. And finally, in connection with what the court did below, they placed the burden on Venegas, which is wrong. They ignored the circumstances at the time, which was an inadequate disclosure of the availability of Section 1988. They ignored the disparity, and they deemed reasonable a contract which is manifestly unenforceable under state and federal law. So for all these reasons, we believe that, number one, the court should adopt the rule that Section 1988 precludes the attorney from receiving more than the court-awarded fee. And if it doesn't emanate from Section 1988, it emanates from what this court, or at least the dissent, said in the Mallard case, and the majority opinion did not indicate to the contrary, that the court has inherent power to regulate the attorney, a special relationship, regardless of whatever a statute says.
Didn't the Ninth Circuit send back to the district court the question of whether this fee was valid under California law?
No, Your Honor. The only thing that they sent back was to determine whether or not they could have a lien basically. In other words, whether or not there was an intention to have a statutory lien.
They didn't leave open the validity of the fee under California
law. Well, that is probably could be litigated in state court, but we believe that the first step should be a question of reasonableness, and that is for the court. If the court decides that it can't decide that, or it doesn't decide that it's unreasonable, then Mr. Venegas has all of his other options.
Thank you, Mr. Musk. Mr. Miller, we'll hear from you.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. As the questions from the court indicate, the central question in this case is whether Congress, in passing Section 1988, intended to restrict or limit in any way the amount that an attorney could charge his client in a civil rights case, and specifically whether Congress intended that the reasonable fee awarded to the prevailing party is the limit on what an attorney can charge that prevailing party pursuant to its own fee agreement. The position that the petitioner argues in this case would prevent an attorney from enforcing any type of contract, contingency fee contract, as in this case, a fixed fee contract, and contract based on an hourly rate basis, any kind of contract that would yield a fee higher than the amount set by the court under Section 1988. Did Congress intend that result by this statute? I think the answer to that has to be no. Nothing on the face of the statute indicates that Congress intended any such intention or that it even addressed the question. For Section 1988 does not address the question of what a prevailing party may voluntarily pay to his lawyer in a civil rights case. Section 1988 deals with what a losing party must pay by order of the court to the prevailing party as a reasonable attorney's fee in a civil rights case. What parties voluntarily contract before a case is decided to pay for legal services. Rather, it is how much a losing party involuntarily may be taxed by the court as an additional recovery to the prevailing party, in this case the plaintiff, to assist in covering the attorney's fee or costs of the case to the prevailing party.
Mr. Miller, could you help me on the facts here? I am a little fuzzy on. Did the amount of the reasonable fee that was charged against the defendant, I guess $75,000 on account of your client's services, did that enhance the total amount against which the 40% contingency was computed?
It did not, Your Honor. I'd like to clarify three things about that. First of all, contrary to what petitioner says, I don't know why he says it, Mr. Mitchell, the attorney here, did ask the court for an enhancement of his fee. He set forth his hours. The lodestar figure was $37,000, and he asked the court for a multiplier of two, and the court gave him a multiplier of two. So he got $75,000.
Did he disclose the contingent arrangement at that time?
He did. His fee application disclosed that he had taken the case on a contingency. It stated that he had received a small retainer. He did not indicate the percentage in this contingency agreement. But the lawyer for the city of Long Beach indicated in his response that typically contingency fee contracts of this kind provided for a contingency of 25 to 40%. He happened to say that to the court. The court, if he thought it was interested, could well have asked Mr. Mitchell. I'm sure he would have told him. But he told him it was a contingent arrangement. The contract that Mr. Mitchell had with his client specifically stated that any recovery under Section 1988 that Mitchell got would be offset the amount of the contingency fee, so that in no event under this agreement could Mr. Mitchell receive more than 40%, and the $10,000 retainer was also credited against the 40%. So that's the most he could have received and would receive if this contract is enforced.
But 40% of what? 40% of the amount, including the attorney's fees that were awarded?
That question hasn't been litigated in this case, but I believe Mr. Mitchell's understanding would be, yes, it would be 40% of the gross amount recovered by the plaintiff in this case.
I just want to make sure I heard it right, including the reasonable attorney's fee.
That would be correct, Your Honor. That's right. It would be 40% of the gross amount recovered by the plaintiff. It would also include, had it not been waived by the
Who do you think is entitled to the statutory attorney's fee, the client or the lawyer?
Your Honor, I think the answer is that the client is entitled to the attorney's fees, and I think that's what this Court held in Evans versus Jeff Deere. That holding is very pertinent to this case because it makes the need for an enforceable fee contract all that much more important to lawyers who are going to represent civil rights plaintiffs.
But it also shows that your contract, to the extent that it seeks to shave away 40% of that, as you've just said it does, contravenes the policy of the statute, which is to give the client the full amount of reasonable attorney's fees. And you're saying he won't get that. He'll lose 40% of it through my fee agreement.
I don't think the policy of the statute is that the lawyer wouldn't share in the attorney's fee payment. I think the understanding of the statute and the contemplation is in the normal case, the attorney will get the attorney's fee awarded by the court depending on what his agreement is with his client.
Your position certainly prevents the plaintiff from being fully compensated, which has to be one of the goals of the Civil Rights Act.
Your Honor, I'd like to answer that in two parts. First of all, the goal of the Civil Rights Act, as stated by this Court in the Blanchard case, was to make, that is Section 1988, was to make sure that competent counsel are available to handle civil rights plaintiffs' cases. And that's been said by this Court repeatedly.
To what end?
Pardon me?
To what end?
To the end that these clients...
To compensate a plaintiff who has been injured.
Correct. And to allow these people, most of whom, according to legislative history, have cases that are not high money cases, to obtain the kind of counsel that plaintiffs in other situations are able to get. It was an effort to equate the civil rights plaintiffs, and give them the wherewithal to pursue their cases in court, even though those cases didn't have large monetary prospects.
Supposing that we had the kind of contingent fee contract that your client had here, and there had been an award of $20,000 damages, and the court says we'll give you $100,000 attorney's fees under Section 1988. Now, how would that amount, you're getting a total of $120,000 from the defendant. How would that be divided between the attorney and the client under this contract?
And I believe under this contract that the attorney would have been entitled to 40%.
40% of $120,000?
Yeah. $48,000 in that case.
And
would not be entitled to the entire amount of the attorney's fees.
Yeah, so the attorney would not have been entitled to keep the $100,000.
That's absolutely correct. Now, I'm catching myself here because I can imagine the next question. You could have a contract, I suppose, in which an attorney provided that I'll get 40% or the court-awarded fee, whichever is greater. Imagine such a contract. And then the answer to your question under the contract would be different.
And if there was no arrangement for attorney's fees at all and you have the same recovery, $20,000 damages, $100,000 attorney's fees, then the attorney gets the $100,000?
Well, I don't think that's clear at all, Your Honor. To me, this Court's holding in the Blanchard case, together with the holding in the Jeff D. case, indicates that the award of attorney's fees goes to the client. It's his entitlement under the statute. Now, it's normally anticipated that that award is for the purpose of compensating an attorney. But if, for example, the attorney has a fee contract with his client that would yield him less than the amount established by the court, I don't think it follows that the attorney is entitled to that amount.
Well, but then our whole we have held under the statute that even though the attorney's agreement provides for less than what the court determines to be a reasonable fee will still be awarded, more than what the contract says.
That is correct, Your Honor.
And you're saying that that what happens to that excess over the contract amount does not go to the lawyer.
Absolutely, if the contract doesn't provide for it, and I don't know why it should. And this court has made clear
very strange holding we made then. I thought when we said that the money was going to go to the lawyer.
Not necessarily. I don't think the court said that, and I don't think it necessarily follows. And there, but
gee, it was the lawyer that was suing in the cases.
No, you've held that the court may award attorney's fees to the prevailing plaintiff in a situation where there is no obligation by the prevailing party to pay anything to his lawyer. That's the Blum case where the public interest firm brought the case.
But with no understanding whatever between a private plaintiff and a private lawyer, an award of $100,000 attorney's fees does not presumptively or automatically go to the lawyer?
Well, when you say presumptively, I think that most courts presume or anticipate that the amount will be paid to the
lawyer. I would think so when they call it attorney's fees.
Well, the statute uses the word attorney's fees, but it says...
Just out of goodwill. They assume out of goodwill it's going to be paid over, you mean.
Judge Kelleher spoke to this, in fact, in his own opinion in this case, and said how this is a vexing issue. Jackie was about to attend a seminar at that time, and being given by some Second Circuit judges to discuss this issue. What happens to attorney's fees when they're awarded? Do they go to the lawyers? But I think that the position that we've advocated here is, and consistent with this court's holdings, is that the statute provides attorney's fees to the plaintiff. If the plaintiff has a fee arrangement with his lawyer, under which the lawyer will be compensated in some different manner than provided for through the award from the court, higher or lower, that's what the attorney gets. And that doesn't seem to me to be unreasonable or unfair to either party.
Counsel, did the petitioner argue in the courts below that the contingent fee agreement was unenforceable as a matter of state law?
He did, Your Honor. He presented a state law ground for not enforcing this agreement, and it was dealt with in Judge Kelleher's opinion, and Judge Kelleher considered it and rejected it. And it's in his opinion that's in the attached as the appendix to the cert petition.
What was left open with respect to the lien? Is that a...
Your Honor, in fact, it was those questions that were left open. The questions as to whether the attorney, in this case Mr. Mitchell, was entitled to a lien for his claim. That issue has since become moot. And it's become moot because subsequent to the decision of the Court of Appeals on the merits of the case, the plaintiff, Mr. Venegas, entered into a settlement agreement. And that settlement agreement established an escrow account for the amount of fee in dispute here. And it sits in escrow awaiting the final judgment as to who's entitled to the attorney's fees. So it made the issue of lien moot, and all parties have agreed to that. So there will be no need to remand those issues to the state court for consideration.
Did the settlement agreement also contemplate that there will be no further state law issues raised in any state proceeding?
I don't think the settlement agreement spoke to that, Your Honor, but we have serious doubts as to whether there are any state law issues that can appropriately be raised at this point if this court affirms the decision below. In the district court, the plaintiff, Mr. Venegas, represented by Mr. Bromberg as his counsel, and I should say how he got to Mr. Bromberg, by the way, he got to Mr. Bromberg because Mr. Mitchell, when he proposed to take the appeal, said to his client, you should seek independent counsel on my proposal for handling your appeal. Mr. Venegas did so, consulted Mr. Bromberg. They concluded that they should not accept Mr. Mitchell's proposal for handling the appeal, and instead Mr. Bromberg agreed to handle himself. And he thereafter represented Mr. Venegas, and he represented Mr. Venegas in the trial court on the question of the enforceability of the contingent fee contract. And he advanced a number of arguments why it shouldn't be enforced. And it's unreasonable, it's excessive, it violates state law. They were all considered by Judge Kelleher. Pursuant to the Ninth Circuit's decision in a case called Hamner versus Rios, and that court sets forth a rather broad standard for lower courts to follow in assessing the reasonableness of attorneys' private fee arrangements in civil rights cases. And Judge Kelleher cited that case, referred to the standards, indicated that he had a broad discretion to apply, then considered the arguments that had been advanced by the Mr. Venegas, including the claim that this was a windfall. And Judge Kelleher, who had seen the trial, he saw the job that the attorney, Mr. Mitchell, had done and knew the facts of the case, concluded that this was a reasonable agreement and ought to be enforced. And the Ninth Circuit sustained that. So we don't see that there's anything left to be decided on the issue of the enforceability of the contract if this court affirms the decision below. If that occurs, Mr. Mitchell's entitled to the sum that his contract provides him.
Would you mind, just so I understand it, I'm really kind of dense, I think. Would you go through the arithmetic of how the fee was computed in this case? First, tell me what the gross amount recovered was in dollars.
It was $2,080,000, Your Honor.
And is that exclusive of the attorney's
fees? That was exclusive of the attorney's fees.
And how much is added to that for the attorney's
fees? Well, the attorney fee award was $117,000.
Is that all done or just the share that's attributable to you?
Well, that's the total amount awarded. And I will say to you, Your Honor, at this point that although I answered your questions to the best of my ability, Mr. Mitchell has not in fact claimed more than 40% of $2,080,000. But I answered your questions as to his entitlement of the contract. But he's only claimed at this point, and only will claim, 40% of $2,080,000 for himself and his colleague, Mr. Cochran.
And he's getting 40% of half of that because his client got
he would get
other half. Lawyer got another the other half.
That's right. Mr. Mitchell would receive I can't do that. It's slightly over $400,000 minus the retainer he's already received, and the balance would be what he would he's entitled to under this contract.
Would you agree, I don't know whether it's open in this case or not, that it would be within the power of a district judge to look at these facts and say, I think this fee is so far above what the reasonable fee computed was that I will hold it at least partially unenforceable?
Yes, Your Honor. I think he had that power, and I think that power was invoked, and Judge Kelleher thought about that issue and decided that it shouldn't be reduced. But he did have the power to do it. I think that is more or less inherent in the power of a federal court. And I agree with Mr. Mosk on that point. That's an inherent power of a court in its supervisory role over attorneys.
What if in exercising it, that's purely a federal power? Does the district judge have to say, well, a state court would allow it, and therefore I must? Or can he say?
I think, Your Honor, that's a tricky question. I think the answer is basically it should be the enforcement of state law. You should apply the state ethical standards applicable in this case, in California.
Because otherwise you're going to have to write in the contract whether you're proposing to sue in federal court or state court.
Agreed. Now, the only qualification I'll make to this is that in the Ninth Circuit decision in Hamner versus Rios, which told the district courts to make this broad inquiry, one of the factors to be taken into account was whether enforcement of the lawyer's contract would be consistent with the policies of the federal civil rights laws. That strikes me as a kind of a federal question over and above the normal state law ethical questions. Perhaps it's embodied in California state law, but I say that's why it's a tricky question. To that extent, in a civil rights case, the determination by the district judge may be more than a purely state law ethical
question. Well, the state would have to take that into account as well.
As I said, I think you could read the state law as to embrace such
to
a
embrace
concept in the appropriate case. And if so, then I think you can say in all aspects he is applying the same approach that would be applied by a superior court judge in a state law proceeding.
And that would be true in a federal Fair Labor Standards Act attorney's fee, every other kind of statutory attorney's fee, too.
Absolutely. There's no question about that. But may I say, Mr. Chief Justice, on that issue, because the issue of the Fair Labor Standards Act cases was raised for the first time in the reply brief, and I hadn't had occasion to consider those before, we did some research on those, because it didn't sound right to what I saw in the brief. And sure enough, what we found is, and I won't belabor this, that those cases themselves and the later cases that have discussed them stand for the proposition which we advance, and that is that it's inappropriate in a case, in that instance, the Fair Labor Standards situation, for an attorney to recover both the statutory fee and his contingent fee under his contract, and that an attorney should be satisfied with a single fee. And I'll just cite to the court two cases that the court may wish to review on this issue. Hauser versus Mattson, 447 F. 2nd, 860. And Hayden versus Bowen, a Fifth Circuit case, 404 F. 2nd, 682. And cert was denied in that case.
You could apply the statutory fee against the contingent fee if the statutory fee were smaller, I suppose.
That's correct, Your Honor. And I think what these cases stand for is that an attorney must apply the statutory fee against his contractual arrangement. That is what Mr. Mitchell's contract provides, by the way. I think Mr. Mitchell felt that California ethics law would require that. Most of the appellate court cases that have dealt with the subject have said that ought to be the rule. A lawyer can't get both. And we're not seeking both in this case, and don't advocate that anyone's entitled to both. But we are advocating that the lawyer is entitled to the benefit of his contract if he carries out his bargain and wins the case and secures the result sought by the plaintiff when he entered into
it. Do you accept the notion that that in setting the fee in this case that the defendant had to pay, that the district court was indicating that this is the kind of, if I award this kind of a fee, it is the kind of a fee that would enable a plaintiff in this kind of a case to get decent counsel?
I'm not sure how to answer the question, Your Honor, because I'm not sure I followed the gist of it.
I suppose the reasonable fee that district courts are supposed to award are fees that respond to the marketplace and that would enable civil rights plaintiffs to get decent counsel. Now, I suppose that this fee that the district court awarded was that kind of a fee in his mind.
I think that's right.
And he nevertheless went ahead and said even though a fee of this kind would have been plenty enough, good enough to get counsel, this contract means that the lawyer is entitled to something more.
Correct, Your Honor. And if a civil rights lawyer felt confident and knew that in taking one of these cases, not necessarily one that had this much damages, but any civil rights case, that if his client prevailed, he would receive a statutory fee from the court, that he might be satisfied. But unfortunately, that's not the situation today. Because of this court's decision in Evans versus Jeff D., most civil rights plaintiffs, lawyers, in most cases are at grave risk of receiving no fee whatsoever, despite their efforts on the client's behalf and successful efforts. And that's because the vast majority of civil rights cases settle, as the vast majority of all cases do. And cities and municipalities, who are usually the defendants, have caught on to the fact that the way you settle these cases is to get the plaintiff to waive attorney's fees under the statute, particularly a case that's been complex and longstanding and where the fees promised to be fairly substantial. So an attorney in a civil rights context is in great risk now, as Mr. Mitchell has been the victim of this on several occasions, as our brief shows, doing a lot of work, achieving the essential results sought by the plaintiff or his client, and then having a settlement made in which a condition of settlement is that his fee is waived. Of course, in that situation, particularly where the defendant offers the client essentially the relief sought, subject only to fee waiver, an ethical lawyer like Mr. Mitchell is in a tough bind. He can't tell his lawyer not to accept the settlement just because he's not being paid his fee. So he counsels acceptance of a settlement that achieves the client's basic objectives, and in the process talks himself out of a statutory-based fee. Now, unless he's got some protection under a lawyer's fee contract, he's going to be out in the cold, and that's why civil rights plaintiffs, lawyers, are going to be discouraged from taking these cases unless the right to contract, as in this case, is sustained.
Well, should the court in reviewing, suppose we think the statute doesn't set a cap, but that the district court does have an obligation to review the reasonableness of the fee agreement, should the court not take into consideration the fact that this case didn't settle, that a reasonable fee was paid, and that a 40% contingency above that on these circumstances seems unwarranted because it reduces the recovery of the plaintiff to such an extent? Now, does anything prevent the district court from considering those things and reducing the so-called contingent fee?
Well, I'd like to answer the question this way, Justice O'Connor. Nothing prevents the district court from considering that. That's an appropriate consideration. In this case, consideration of that would be as follows, I think, because fortunately, as unlike other cases, we have sort of a benchmark here as to what the client's loss was, and the petitioner himself has said he had a state court antecedent proceeding in which he was awarded damages of $1 million, which was reversed on state law grounds. And says the petitioner, this case was easy. You already knew he had a $1 million suit here, and all Mr. Mitchell had to do was try it and collect $1 million. In this case, it wasn't that easy, by the way, for reasons I'll come to. But in this case, Mr. Mitchell secured a judgment of $2 million. Venegas went out and got the best he could find, and it produced a result twice what the so-called benchmark was. So even after you deduct the 40%, Mr. Mitchell and his colleague are entitled under their contract. The client here has been made more than whole by any sort of generalized benchmark standard one can look at. So on the facts of this case, which is what the plaintiff has tendered here, certainly it's not unreasonable to enforce the contract. He got the benefit of his bargain.
Did the district court here even talk about anything with regard to the reasonableness of the fees, or did the district court just say, well, that was the agreement the plaintiff signed?
No, the district court addressed the issue presented to him as to whether the recovery to the lawyers would constitute a windfall. He used that term in his opinion, and he said it would not be. He didn't write a 12-page opinion on the subject, but he saw the trial, he knew the background, he's an experienced judge, and he concluded that it was a fair, he knew about the state court judgment, I'm sure, before, obviously he knew about that, and he concluded it was not a windfall.
To Justice O'Connor suggests that the damages really should have only been $1 million. Here he recovered $2 million. I think we have to assume that was the correct measure of his injury.
I think, Your Honor, what this tells you is that in cases like this where the special damages were very small and virtually the entire judgment was general damages, is that there's a wide range of what's appropriate recovery in cases like this. And how much a plaintiff is going to recover in a case of this kind is highly dependent on the skill of his lawyer. In this case, Mr. Venegas went for the best. He got the best. He got the result that one hopes for, no guarantee, but he hopes for it when he goes for the best. And now that he got the result he wanted, and he got the full benefit of that bargain, he wants to renege on it as far as paying the fellow who did it for him.
Well, of course, that's often true, that in a bargain, a contingent fee case is there's not exactly precise equality of bargaining power when the contract is made. There's no doubt about that. Let me ask you another question. You argued earlier about the FLSLA cases that say you can't have both the statutory award and the contractual award. But here, your contract, in effect, gave you the statutory award, the contractual award plus 40% of the statutory award. So you didn't get just one. You get one and four tenths.
Up to now, Mr. Mitchell's never sought that.
No, you've never sought it, but that's what the contract.
You asked about that, and I tried to answer fairly as to what I thought the contract could be interpreted. The contract says the gross amount recovered.
But I'm just suggesting there is some tension between the contract in this case and that principle that you get one or the other.
To that slight degree, yes. My time is about up, but I'd just like to come back to the basic point that started this dispute and which is the principal issue presented in the cert petition, and that is, did Congress provide, as it could have, that there should be limitations on the enforceability of fee contracts when they exceed the amount awarded under the 1988 provision? Congress has shown its ability to do that in a variety of situations when it has wanted to do so. But I would like to leave with the sort of the fountainhead case in this area that started all this to begin with, the Alyeska case, which is the case that led the Congress to enact Section 1988. And there, in rejecting the notion that the court should on its own conclude to award plaintiff's attorneys fees in successful civil rights cases, Justice White's opinion for the court said that that approach would make, I'm quoting now, would make major inroads on a policy matter that Congress has reserved for itself. And in rejecting the rule in that case that had been adopted by the court below, this court said that the law concerning attorneys' fees, quote, is deeply rooted in our history and in congressional policy. And it is not for us to invade the legislature's province by redistributing litigation costs in the manner suggested by respondents, end quote. I submit to the court that that's what's being asked in this case. The petitioners here are asking this court to invade the legislative province and to redistribute litigation costs in the manner, in this case, quite favorable to the prevailing plaintiff who has secured the benefit of his bargain. This plaintiff actually concedes a role for these private contracts. In his brief, he says, well, when they settle, then maybe, and part of the settlement is waiver of the attorney's fees under Section 1988, then perhaps an attorney can enforce his private contract. Well, if you can enforce
Thank you, Mr. Miller. The case is submitted.